Good evening. Wow, that really worked. Good evening. My name is Paul LeClaire, and for those of you whom I haven't had the pleasure of meeting yet, it's my great honor to be the president of the New York Public Library, the greatest library in the world, we think. And on behalf of our Board of Trustees and the Council of Conservators and our staff, I'm really very, very happy to welcome you to the Celeste Bartos Forum this evening for the second in a three-part series, one each year, devoted to philanthropy in the 21st century. This series exists as a consequence of the great generosity of the Bank of New York Mellon, and we hope that all of you come back next year for the third and final part of these evenings at the library devoted to the key issue of philanthropy. Can the sound person turn the sound up, please? Thank you. Can you hear now? All right. This is two out of three, one more next year, brought to you through us by the Bank of New York Mellon as a consequence of a very generous gift that was solicited by Ed Gardner, a dear friend of ours and of the board of the library. A special word of thanks as well to Kathy Rayner, Trustee Kathy Rayner, and her fellow Council of Conservator co-chairs Susan Morgenthau and Robin McNeil, and all of their leadership for providing us with another great evening, and with Ed Gardner as well for this series. This is a very exciting time for the New York Public Library, as you've probably been reading in the press. We have a bold new strategy outline that received accolades in the Daily News and an editorial on Monday. We're expanding the library services across the board, both in physical buildings such as this and throughout our 87 branch libraries, and we're expanding our services to the public through the website. Many of you, but perhaps not all of you, realize that you are presently in a private library under private control and supported almost entirely by the private sector. The name of this library can be somewhat misleading. Perhaps we should say this is the New York Private Library, open to the public as a consequence of private philanthropy. Only one-third of our operating budget for this library that you're in tonight comes from the public sector. The rest is entirely from the private sector. And the various groups that help us, the Council of Conservators and the Conservators themselves, are key to the library's success and its greatness. So if you believe in what we do here, which is to open one of the single greatest collections ever assembled in human history to the broadest public imaginable, completely for free, then support us. If you're not a Council of Conservator, or if you're not a conservator already, join that important group. If you are a conservator, upgrade. Come up to a higher level, because that will give us just ever more resources to convert into purchases for the public. Books, computers, CDs, all kinds of things that the public needs and wants and that we love to provide. So we're the greatest democratic library that's ever existed, I think, and we couldn't do what we do without you as friends. So if you haven't embraced us yet with a check made out to the New York Public Library, I beg you to do so. It's the single best investment you'll make today, and you will help this library in important kinds of ways in continuing to be absolutely great. Our evening tonight is going to be a very, very special one because we have two remarkable individuals to speak to us in conversation. Tonight's forum, Conversations on the Power of Giving, Social Business, takes a look at a particularly timely and thought-provoking topic with a spotlight on its leading proponent. We are honored indeed to have as our very special guest the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Dr. Muhammad Yunus. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful to Peter Osnos, his publisher, for having provided access to us to Dr. Yunus tonight. Known the world over as the banker of the poor, Dr. Yunus is that rare thing, a bona fide visionary. His dream is the total eradication of poverty from the world. But microcredit, as he has invented it and spread it across many parts of the world, is only half of what Dr. Yunus wants to leave as his own personal legacy. Social business enterprise, he says, is next on his list. This idea marries the interests of corporations with economic development in ways that have never been tried before. His groundbreaking work in harnessing the power of the free market to address the problems of poverty, hunger, and inequality has been replicated in over 100 countries to date and earned him, of course, the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. In addition to that very great prize, the greatest of all, Dr. Yunus and the Grameen Bank are the recipients of numerous international awards, including the Independence Day Award, Bangladesh's highest honor, the King Hussein Humanitarian Leadership Award, and the Gandhi Peace Prize. Dr. Yunus is the author of two books, Banker to the Poor, Microlending, and the Battle Against World Poverty, and the recently published Creating a World Without Poverty, Social Business, and the Future of Capitalism. And I'm pleased to say that Dr. Yunus visited this library back when he was a graduate student in economics at Emory University some time ago, and it's wonderful to have him back this evening. Thank you very much for coming back tonight, Dr. Yunus. We are fortunate indeed to have Fareed Zakaria, one of this country's most distinguished journalists and foreign policy experts, as the leader of this evening's conversation with Dr. Yunus. Dr. Zakaria is the editor of Newsweek International, overseeing all of Newsweek's editions abroad that reach an audience of 24 million readers worldwide. He writes a regular column for Newsweek, which also appears in its international editions, and he writes a biweekly column for The Washington Post. A former commentator for ABC News, Dr. Zakaria now hosts a foreign affairs show on CNN Worldwide and is a frequent guest on Jon Stewart's Daily Show. He was the managing editor of Foreign Affairs, the widely circulated journal of international politics and economics, and is the author of several books, really important books, including The Future of Freedom, a New York Times bestseller that has been translated into 20 languages. His new book, The Post-American World, has just been published. There will be a question and answer period following tonight's program, and that we ask that you use the microphones on either side of the hall in asking your questions. Dr. Yunus and Dr. Zakaria will both be available to sign their most recent books after our program tonight. You can purchase them here at the same time that you write your check to become a conservator or to upgrade. At the conclusion of the program, there are tables to my right, your left, at which those books will be available. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving the most warm welcome to Dr. Yunus and Dr. Zakaria.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all so much for coming. This is a great, great pleasure for me. The last time I saw Muhammad Yunus, he was kind enough to do me the honor of visiting me in my office in 2006. And I said to him as we parted, something great is going to happen to you, Muhammad. And a few weeks later, he won the Nobel Peace Prize. Okay, I made up that last part about what I said. But it is in fact true that a few weeks later he won the Nobel Prize. So let me ask you a question that I'm sure everybody wants to know. We'll get to microfinance, don't worry. What's it like to win the Nobel Peace Prize? What's the best thing about that?
Oh, this is fantastic. I mean, you cannot. We know about Nobel Prize and we all admire it. But when it happens to a person, the enormous focus you get from the whole world, and you feel like you are under the floodlight, and whatever you are saying, even if you whisper, everybody is hearing you. So for me, it was something very good, because I'm always trying to tell people about our experience and the issues that I raise, and sometimes I try to do it by screaming, but nobody hears me. So now I take the advantage that I can whisper, people can hear. So it's enormous respectability, credibility, and people admire that prize so much. There are hundreds of, probably thousands of awards all around the world, but nothing gets at that level that the Nobel Prize.
Do you feel that it amplified your voice in a way that made you think, okay, what should I do with this platform now? Because this is a quantum leap in a
Absolutely,
sense.
Absolutely, yeah.
And do you have any thoughts about how to use this platform in a way that might be even different.
Yeah. One way is how to use this, and at the same time, keep in mind, this position may not last long. Because next Peace Prize winner comes and other exciting thing happens to the world, people forget. So while it is on, how to make the best use of it so that you take advantage of people's attention and quickly, briefly tell what needs to be done. And that's what I'm trying to do. That's why I move around a lot, meeting people who want to meet. But the enormous amount of mails you get and invitations, even if you continue to work every single moment, still you cannot take a fraction of those things. But I try to choose the ones that has a lot more visibility and a lot more attention at the level of attention and so on. So bringing those ideas about microcredit and also social business, both of them together.
Okay, this is now, you know, when Mick Jagger does a concert, people are happy to hear the new music, but they want to hear him sing Satisfaction. So you've probably told this story 100 times. Why did what made you stumble upon the idea of microcredit? You're a professor in Bangladesh, dabbling in a little bit of business.
That's right.
And then what happens?
The business part was much earlier than teaching. When I was first came out of Dhaka University with my master's degree and I started teaching, at that time I was dabbling with business. That's after I did my PhD, came back, it was exclusively teaching. And all the excitement of having now a new country to go work with. And our hopes is now we can solve all our problems and so on. That's not how it went. It went down very quickly. And in 1974, we ended up with a famine, people dying of hunger. So here I am teaching all those grand, elegant theories of economics, freshly learned from the best universities in the world. And you have that arrogance that you know everything, but you see that you're totally useless in the face of the poverty and in the face of the famine that is going on right outside your campus. So then I said, after a while, out of frustration, I said, forget about it. Textbook economics is not going to help me anyway. So why don't I just be a simple human being as it is and go and find out another human being that I can make myself useful to? I don't know what it is, but I'm sure I'll find something that I can do to another person to even to be useful for a day. So that's what my intention became. And it was very easy for me because the university that I was teaching in Bangladesh was surrounded by villages. It's right in the middle of the villages. So I can just walk out of the classroom, the campus border, and be in the village.
This is in Dhaka or in Chittagong?
In Chittagong. And I would walk around in the village and get to know them, and they were getting to know me. They were surprised that the university professor is walking around in the village. So I got to know them and started doing a little bit of things. Then I saw loan sharks in the village, how they operate. And it came because I met a woman who was extremely poor making beautiful bamboo stool. And looking at her, the way the clothes she is wearing, all tattered clothes, dirty clothes, and she's making beautiful bamboo stool, fresh bamboo stool. It's a contrast between her and the product she's making. So I couldn't believe that one can make such beautiful things and remain such poor. So I said, what is this reason? Poverty is related to not having a skill, not being able to do something. Here is a completely different case. So I sat down with her and tried to understand. After a long conversation, found out that she cannot make money. She makes only 2 pennies a day because she had to borrow from the trader to buy the bamboo, which goes into the bamboo product. And the price of the bamboo is 25 cents. She didn't have the 25 cents to buy that. So the trader put the condition that whatever she produces, everything has to be sold to him. At the price, he decides. She has no option to go and check out the price in the market. So I said, my God, this is not lending. This is turning people into slave labor. So I went around for the next several days to find out there are other people like her. So when my list was complete, there were 42 names on that list. Yes. And the total money they borrowed was $27. So that's what I couldn't believe, that people have to suffer so much for so little. and people, nobody is doing anything about it. So I thought, I can solve this problem. It's a very simple solution. If I give this $27 to them, they can return the money to the loan sharks and they will be free. Nobody can torture them anymore. And exactly that's what I did. And I thought, this is one more work I did. I feel happy, but I didn't expect any something repercussion from it. But from then on, people were looking at me as if I've done some miracle. They look at me in a very strange way. I said, my God, for $27, you turn into an angel of something. And I said, maybe if I give another $27, probably I'll become a super angel. So that thought came, if you can make so many people so happy with such a small amount of money, why shouldn't you do more of it? So that's what I wanted to do. And then I thought maybe I should link the bank in the campus with the people. And when I tried to do that, bank manager said, no way, you cannot lend money to the poor people. So that controversy with the bank and the entire banking system and all the arguments went on for 8 months. They wouldn't open the door. They were hiding behind their rules. I said, okay, accept me as a guarantor. I'll sign every paper that you give and give the money to the people. So that's how it began in 1976, and it worked. So briefly, this is how it all began.
And were there forces of opposition? I mean, the loan sharks must have been opposed. There must have been a whole system of control and in cartels that were disempowered by what you were doing.
It's amazing. When you do something new, in how many directions everybody attack you? Because it doesn't fit into what's supposed to be. You mentioned loan sharks. They were the first one because we are taking away their clients. The other one, which I didn't realize but immediately got into it, I decided right from the beginning, half the borrowers in my program must be women. This is because all these 8 months of screaming that I have done about the conventional banking in Bangladesh, I said not only the conventional banks are wrong by rejecting the poor people, they are also wrong because they reject the women of any category, even the rich woman is rejected. And of course, banks didn't like that accusation. They said, no, the women don't come to us. I said, no, that's not true. Not even 1% of the borrowers happen to be women. Your rules are so tilted. If a woman wants to take a loan from you, even if she's a rich woman, manager will always ask, have you discussed it with your husband?
Yeah.
If she says, yes, I have done that. I said, why don't you bring your husband along so that we can discuss the business? I said, has it ever occurred in the history of Bangladeshi banking, a man brought his proposal and the manager saying, have you discussed it with your wife? Why didn't you bring your wife along so that we can discuss the business? I said, that's where you went wrong. So anyway, when I began, I wanted to be absolutely sure that half the borrowers in my program are women. So when I went to the women, and women said, no, not to me. Give it to my husband. I don't know anything about money. I never handled money in my life. So when I was trying to do that, men ganged up against me. They thought I'm deliberately insulting them.
Yeah.
How dare you give a loan to my wife while I'm still around? So the men became another problem. Then religion came into the picture. The men ganged up. They got the interpretation from the religious leaders, the Maulanas. They said, you are destroying our religion by giving
because
money to women.
Because of interest.
Just because of women. Interest, they accept because all banks charge interest. Yeah. They cannot attack me that seriously. But giving money to women. They said, if you give money to women, they will be walking in the street. Next day, you know, they're defying everything that Islam says. So it became a very serious opposition. Then we started campaigning that this is not true. Islam doesn't say anything about women not being in business. And then we came up with the historical stories about how women were treated in Islamic history. One story came in very handy. He said, you know what? Prophet took his first job under a businesswoman.
Yeah, that's right.
And later he married her. I said, we then started saying that if you want to be a good Muslim, you must follow the principle and the life of the Prophet. If you want to be a good Muslim, you should marry a businesswoman. And if you can't find one, come to us. We'll introduce you. So we had to kind of come up with ways people can react and so on. That story helped us so much. No, everybody knew that story.
Right.
Nobody could say anything about it. They could come up on other things. I said, no. This is a business moment. It's a very clear case. Yeah. So, but it's still very difficult to tone down those things. Political opposition came. Political opposition was, this is American conspiracy. You are bringing capitalism here. We want to have a socialist revolution. So why are you bringing capitalism? This is a conspiracy hedged by CIA. Yeah. So all kinds of arguments and counter-arguments. In the meantime, we said, let's proceed. Let them argue. Let them do whatever they want to do. So we continued. Opposition was there.
But now, when you thought about this and you started expanding it, at that time, the World Bank, foreign aid, the whole idea behind solving poverty was big projects,
right.
Dams,
yeah.
Infrastructure of various kinds, very large-scale rural financing schemes, nothing like what you were doing.
Sure.
Did you look at that and think to yourself, that's wrong, or was it just that you were inductively looking at the ground? Were you thinking about those broader issues?
In the beginning, I was not thinking about those issues. It came as a problem for me, and it's an immediate problem. I was looking for an immediate solution. And within that boundary, it worked very well. I didn't have to worry about them. But as we grew, this controversy became bigger and bigger now. Our colleagues in economics department and all the economist professionals, they were saying, this is silly thing what you're doing. This has nothing to do with development. I said, it depends what you mean by development. To me, development means if a person has only 1 meal a day and somehow he or she can have now 2 meals a day, that to me is a development. If somebody has only one piece of clothing for her and she cannot have a change of clothes, if some miracle she gets a second piece of cloth, that is development to me. So that's how I look at it. In your case, probably you're looking at how many miles of highway, how many power stations you have. That's your measurement. My measurement is the quality of life of the people that I see, and at the very bottom. To me, that's important thing. But they didn't pay any attention. So they started saying that you need investment. Industrialization, that's the key, infrastructure. Yeah. So that's what the industrialization and the infrastructure, the World Bank and everybody else is doing. I said, let them do, but my test of development is how much its impact on the people at the very bottom. If you can build a highway, but if it doesn't help the poor people, I will not consider that as a part of development. That may be part of some of your dream, but it's not part of the development. And that highway may have two impacts. It may help poor people improve their life because of the communication facility opened up, or it may take away their livelihood. That highway did of reverse, then I'll say it's anti-development. Bridge, for example. If you build a bridge, all the boatmen and everybody else, they lost their job. They cannot do anymore. Yeah. So you have to see how much impact you're making on the poor people. Otherwise, just mileages would not add up to anything for that. So that controversy, again, remained strong. At the same time, they're giving agricultural loans through the conventional agricultural banks. And I said, this is, again, a silly thing that you do in the name of agriculture, in the name of development. You're giving all these loans, which never get paid back. So if you're calling it banking, it should be banking. You should get your money back. They said, no, our people are very poor. I said, I deal with extremely poor and women. Our repayment is very good. It's a 99%, 100% repayment. So you just don't blame the poor people for non-repayment. These are pretty well-off people. These are landed people. Having land is a big status in Bangladesh because very, very few people own the land. So again, this is a controversy, the policies and so on. Policies look nice in the policy papers and the documentations and so on. But when you see the reality of it, it's a completely different kind of thing. So those controversies.
And in fact, the subsidies, the loans to rice farmers in Bangladesh are one of the principal causes for the food shortages that you have in much of Asia.
Right.
You are creating a dysfunctional system of agriculture which has produced very low productivity, right? So even though there's greater and greater demand for rice, you don't have rising production or productivity.
Right. Again, I'm not totally against subsidy. I said it has to be a specific purpose. And it should be a permanent thing. If you have difficulty to overcome, yes, sometimes you need to do that, overcome those difficulties. But subsidies once get introduced, the problem is it gets expanded. It's not withdrawn. Then the wrong people get into the picture. Those who want to misuse the subsidy, rather than it's intended for the poorest people, it gets into the people who are already privileged.
It becomes a game for how do you get money
from the political power game that becomes. That's what goes wrong.
Now, there are still critics who say that micro-lending, the problem is these people are using it for consumption. That if you study the loans, they're not using it to start businesses. You know, there's a small percentage that do, but that a large number are using it for consumption, and that is why, even though you've had expansion of microcredit, you've not seen, you know, sustained rises in productivity or per capita GDP. So do they have a point?
No, they don't have a point, because the whole idea that, as we introduced microcredit, the very term came later on, but work began first. It's defined as a small loan for the poorest people for income-generating activity. Unless you can substantiate that this money will create income for you in a way you have to define how it is doing that, you don't get the loan. It's not for consumption purposes. We went into big controversy when we introduced the housing loan.
Right.
Because everybody said, now you're going to consumption loan. And the central bank will not let us introduce housing loan, saying that you always did the income generating loan. Why are you giving consumption loan? So I have to argue, saying that, no, this is for poor people. House is not a consumption item. This is a productive item. And then still they didn't like that idea. They rejected it. I came back arguing that, look, let's not call it a housing loan then. Let's call it a factory loan. Because I said our borrowers are mostly women.
They work.
They work at home. For them, that home is the factory. So you have to look at it that way. It's not simply a place where you come to rest. This is a place of work for them. And this is what they do. Ultimately, a lot of debate and so on, but we got it. So on the basis that it is productive, because Bangladesh is a monsoon country. It's a downpour almost 4 months a year. If you have a leaky roof, if you have a place that you cannot even keep dry, what kind of function you can perform inside the house? You are sewing things, you are making things, the downpour is coming outside. You can't function. So I said, for them to have a dry floor first before they can become functional is a very important thing. And the loan we are talking about was about $300 for housing loan. That's creating such a big controversy. So this one came in the borderline. People say it's a consumption loan. I still feel this is a very productive loan. Otherwise, Grameen Bank is always lending money for income-generating purposes. That's why people say, what do you do? I take the money and buy a cow and sell the milk and pay back the man. You have to show what is your income flow out of this investment. And are you making enough money to pay back the loan? Still have some surplus for you every week. And then that you get the loan. And everything in Grameen Bank is done in terms of five-member group. So five women will get together, form themselves into a group. And that and the way we use the group, if I'm a group member, I want to take a loan, I have to get the approval of my group first. And they will really grill me. Why I'm taking this loan, what kind of use I'll make this loan for, and how I'm paying back. Until they're satisfied, they will not recommend this to the bank.
And what made you think of this, of creating these social groupings?
It came step by step. It was not done right away. First, it was daily repayment. Every day you pay a tiny bit. Administratively, it became very complicated. Then we said that why don't we come at one place every week, so we make the payment. So we came in one place. As we are expanding, tiny little place getting too crowded for this. And so then we said, okay, some people come on Sunday, some people come on Monday. So the beginning of the group. So Monday group and Sunday group. Then we still expanding. Then even that grouping by day didn't work well very well. Then we said, those who took the loan for cows, they belong to the cow group. Those who did the for basket making, you're the basket making group. Then some group are very small, two or three people, and some group was enormous, it's 50 people in one group. So that was not working either. Then we decided to forget about cow and basket. It's, you find four other friends, make yourself a group, five people, and come together. And then we deal with you. And then you look at each other, how everything is going. So you mutually draw strength, inspiration from each other.
And there's, in your telling, there is a real peer pressure. There's a sense that you will not default on the loan because you'll be letting down the other four.
Exactly. And I would put more as a peer support rather than peer pressure, because it's not too much of a coercion. It's more, if you are in trouble, we all go and help you out. Because in our system, we always try to build a system which doesn't believe in any kind of punishment. So no punishment is introduced in our system. So even if I'm not paying back, somebody is not going to punish me because I'm not paying back. We have
what happens if you don't pay?
Long discussion before you even come to the Grameen Bank. As you form a group, we ask the question to the group member, if one of your group member doesn't pay, what will you do as a group member? An initial response, no, she has to pay. She's in our group, we'll make sure she pays. I said, no, that's not the way it's be done. That's not the Grameen Bank way. And what is the Grameen Bank way? We said, look, anytime somebody cannot pay but doesn't pay, your first response should be, oh my God, she's in trouble. After all, she's your friend. How can you get angry with her? And if you try to find out why she didn't pay, you'll find out that every case of non-repayment has a sad story behind it. Maybe, most likely case, her husband took the money and ran away. Now, what's the use of getting angry with her? She's not at fault. Husband took the money. If you're a good friend with her, go and catch the husband. No.
I can see why the men don't like you.
Yeah. So that's how we kind of bring the reality of the situation. His job is to help overcome the problem. Otherwise, poor people will always have problems. So you cannot just punish everybody. Then everybody will be out of the system because you punished off everybody.
Now, this would seem like a system that wouldn't work because you don't have a punishment. You don't have any consequences.
Exactly. But no punishment, no collateral, right. No lawyers.
Right.
Still it works.
And the repayment rate is
99% always, yeah. Even today we are doing in New York City, Jackson Heights, and repayment rate is 100% with the same five-member group, same system, weekly repayment. So it's not something peculiar to Bangladesh. It's today the Grameen idea, Grameen principles are adopted all over the world. And in every single country, same result. There are programs in Africa, programs in Latin America, in Europe, in all over Asia. So it's the same system.
How did you raise the money for the bank? Where did you go to get it?
Yeah. See, it's a funny thing. We didn't need any money. First money came $27 from my pocket. And then, as I was telling, for 8 months, all the struggle, and I offered myself as a guarantor. All I'm doing is signing papers. I didn't need any money because bank is giving money from their source because I stand guarantee for them. So money is not involved. Money became involved when we first saw that the banks are not going to keep on supporting this. They are reluctant. And we want to speed up the whole process. Then we said, why don't we create a bank of our own? Then the question of money, who puts up the capital? So what we did, Grameen Bank not only lends money, also requires every borrower to have a bank account. And every week, even put tiny little money into that bank account. Our idea is, even if it's tiny amount, if you do it repeatedly over months and years, the amount gets big. So they were always putting money in the savings account. So our first thought came, why don't we take this savings from them, explain to them why we're doing that. This will be invested as the capital into the bank. And my suggestion before the legislation was made for this bank, that the borrowers of the bank will be the owners of the bank. So their savings will be the share capital. And that's how it was done. Something like all we pulled when in 1983 we became bank, just about $100,000 for all the money that we can get.
From how many people?
At that time, there will be about 200,000 people, something like that.
So you're 200,000 shareholders.
Today now, 7.5 million shareholders. So
you've given out about $7 billion of loans, and it's all on this principle, from this initial capital.
From this initial capital. So capital was done. Internally, we had no problem. But as we are doing it, in 1982, for the first time, external people started coming. IFAD was the first group who came. So we want to give you some money. Until now, taking money, having money, it never occurred to our mind. IFAD say, it's such a beautiful program, we want to give some money. And we said, look, we have the money. Why do we need the money? He said, no, you don't need it, but we want to give it. You can expand it. I said, even if you want to expand it, we still don't need money, because we are, at that time, all the banks were opening their accounts with us. So we had no problem with the funds. So anyway, after 1 year of negotiation, finally we agreed to take that money. So this was the first time taking external money at their initiative. Once we started accepting, many other donors started giving us money. So we said, okay, once we accept it, let's keep on expanding.
And you would use the money to expand without recourse to banks.
We just keep on expanding and expanding. Then people in international conferences everywhere, we keep hearing, oh, Grameen Bank is a great idea, but it works only because donors are pouring in money to this. I said, that's not true. We didn't want to take the money. They wanted to give us money. That's why we took the money. We don't need the money as such. So we debated and debated. We said, why don't we stop taking the money? And then at one point in 1995, we just decided that we are not going to take anybody's money anymore. And the donors were very unhappy that we don't want to take their money, because the money was in the pipeline. We said, no more money. So 1995 onwards, we have never taken any money from outside, anybody. We had a serious crisis in 1998 when we had a serious flood, if you remember. It's a devastating flood in the whole country. And we were in need of money, because all the money that we lent before, they cannot pay back now. And we cannot insist to pay back, because everything is gone after that flood. So we are looking around what to do. We don't want to go back to the donors, because we made a promise that we are not going to take it. So what we did, we issued bonds in the market and raised money. And with that money, we started again, giving fresh loans and so on. And within 3 years, we paid back the bond money. Everything is clear. So we have plenty of money. All we do, take deposits, just like any other bank, and lend money to the poor people.
And your margins are pretty high.
Yes, we on the interest rate, we charge 20% interest on the income-generating loan. And we charge 8% on housing loan, 5% on student loan, and 0% on loans to beggars. We also give loans to the beggars. That's 0%. If you compare with the conventional banks, their highest interest is 16% on quarterly compounded. Ours is 20% simple interest. So it's very close. But the deposit interest rate, the highest interest rate is 12% on deposits. Lowest is 8.5%. So if you look at our four interest rate, only one interest rate is above the deposit rate. All three of them are below the deposit rate. So we cross-subsidize it by the one that we have on the 20%.
But the whole enterprise is profitable.
Profitable, and sometimes we even gave them 100% dividend, 20% dividend.
So and you return the profit as dividend?
As dividend back to the borrower. So it's all internally done. Nothing goes outside to anybody else. It's their own bank. Bank makes profit. Profit goes back to them.
Let's talk about the gender issue that you raised, because you point out that you said initially that the women must be half of the people getting the loans. That was completely novel at the time. Today it is almost a received wisdom in the aid community that you have to give loans to women, and basically that if you give the loans to the men, they go to the bar and drink it. And if you give it to the women, they spend it on the children's education.
Yes, right.
And, it's entirely a reversal of what people thought. Is that your experience, that women are more likely to repay loans than the men?
It took us 6 years to achieve that goal of 50-50, because women were not coming forward. Literally, they were running away from us, saying that if we, almost like if we enter the village from one direction, they will run the other direction. They are coming to give you money. So, just, they were scared to death because they never handled money.
And there might have been repercussions at home for having that kind of...
They were protective of that. So it needed a lot of our work to build confidence in them and also negotiate with the husband so that nothing wrong had happened to her. After 6 years, we have done this 50-50, and we are very happy that we have achieved that goal that we set for ourselves. Then what we started noticing, the money that went to the family through women brought so much more benefit to the family compared to the money going to the family through men, same amount of money. Women took very good care of the money, very cautious. They got the much better mileage with the money. And immediately the benefit flows to the children. Either children are better fed, or if they are already better fed, they are sent to school now. Something is happening different than it before. But you don't see those signs in the families where men is the borrower. Women had a longer vision. They want to build up to something. They're very cautious as they take the next step. Men always wanted to enjoy right away rather than wait for tomorrow. Tomorrow can take care of itself and so on. So looking at those aptitude in both sides and seeing it repeatedly what is happening to the household, we started questioning the whole principle of 50-50. What's so good about 50-50? Why don't we focus on women? And then at one point we decided, then from now on we are going to focus on women. And we started doing that. And that led us to now today 97% women.
And is the 97% women a naturally occurring distribution? Or are you really biased towards women?
We're very, very biased to the women. Because men are always jumping around to get the money.
Yeah.
When a man comes, we said, well, yes, of course.
You say, have you discussed it with your wife? why don't you send your wife here?
Almost. We said, okay, our bank's policy, our first job is to make sure all the women get the loan first. When we exhaust all the women, and then we'll come to the men.
Now, but do you have any larger reflections on this? I mean, you're in a city where Wall Street is dominated by men. In a country where business is dominated by men. This is also true in Bangladesh.
Sure.
How do you explain that?
I faced that issue many, many times. One particular occasion is very interesting. It's 10 years after we became a bank in 1986. Bangladeshi Bankers Association, they are holding a seminar and invited me to be present to see what happened during the 10 years of Grameen Bank. They were very critical, saying that, oh, nothing really happened, poor people are still poor and so on, all kinds of things. And they said three occasions in this discussion, senior bank official said, you know what, Dr. Yunus, you should change the name of your bank. You should call it Grameen Women's Bank. And this is the same thing repeated three times during the discussion. So when my turn came to respond to all these questions and what impact and so on, I was answering this particular one. I said, I'm absolutely ready to change the name of my bank, Grameen Bank. I'll call it Grameen Women's Bank. It's a very legitimate thing to say because 73% of our, at that time, 73% of our borrowers are women. But before I do that, you have to change the name of your bank. Because you are 99% men. So why don't you call it X Men's Bank, Y Men's Bank, Z Men's Bank? Because of the same logic. Same logic that you are applying to me. I'm only 73% woman. So my turn will come much later. From then on, nobody has suggested to change. The lesson that I have learned again and again, this question of women, everywhere I go, the first question the journalist or anybody will ask, Dr. Yunus, why so many women? Now I tell them, when I am asked that question, I said, have you ever asked any other bank why so many men? Because as long as it's with men, it's okay.
Right.
The moment it's woman, something fishy, something different, something wrong with the system. So people keep asking that. I said, that's how our mind is set, that woman is peculiar, you handle things in it, for a woman, then something you are doing wrong, you have to publicize it, you have to admit it that you are doing the wrong thing. So I said, just ignore it. Just make same, similar. It should be asymmetrical. It shouldn't be asymmetrical. It's symmetrical. If you are not using men, why should the women use it in their bank, the women's bank, and so on? So this is the man-woman question always comes that repeatedly. Today that has been accepted because it became natural part of Grameen microcredit. All over the world, microcredit has become synonymous with the small loans to poor women. Everywhere it's almost 100% women. Even then, when we do it in Jackson Heights, it's 100% women.
Really?
It's 100%.
But Axion, which is one of the largest microcredit people, and they do a lot of work in Latin America,
right,
they say they have a lot of men.
Maybe, but microcredit, the way the Grameen microcredit is synonymous with women, like we do.
And do you actively, say, in Jackson Heights, is there something you do that actively seeks women?
Yeah, we say the women program. Yeah. This is for women only. We are involved in Costa Rica, Guatemala, in Kosovo, in many other places. 100% women. It's nobody. Nobody had any problem doing that.
Have you had other problems in other Islamic countries? Because as you say, there is a particular issue, not really with anything in Islam, but, in the religious, but the cultural customs associated with it in many Muslim countries.
I was recently in Dubai in an Islamic banking conference. They invited me to hear me out. So I went there. They were discussing about the success of the Islamic banking and so on. Then repeatedly question come to Grameen Bank addressing me. Do you consider is your bank is Islamic bank? Or why do, oh no, first question came, why don't you form it as an Islamic bank? Then I asked the question, have you decided that Grameen Bank is not an Islamic bank so that I have to now convert it into Islamic bank? Yeah, of course you are not following the law, the Sharia and so on. You are not doing that. I said, in which way? Because we charge interest. Is this the only reason? Yeah, you charge interest. So it's haram in Islam. Why you charge interest? I said, I have been doing this all these 31 years. I have faced this question many times. In Bangladesh, I have faced this. I face it more in the Middle East. I faced it in Pakistan very strongly. Why you do this? And then gradually another group of Islamic scholars coming to my rescue said, don't listen to all this question. They don't understand what Islamic banking is. You are doing excellent. You are perfectly Islamic. You have no problem. I said, how do I explain this? They said, very simple explanation. They said, Islam had made interest haram, banned. You cannot accept it because it's a tool of exploitation. That's why you do it in many religions. That way it is seen that way, and that's why it has been discouraged. Islam has banned it completely. In your case, Grameen Bank is owned by the borrowers. So the owners cannot exploit themselves. No matter what you call, this is semantics. The idea is exploitation. Nothing is there in your system which exploits. And you are giving back the money. The profit goes back to them. So I said, look, this is the interpretation. And you have been discussing, and I'm hearing about profit sharing and all that, Islamic banking. I said, we don't share profit. We give the entire profit. You want to share with somebody else. But here in Grameen Bank, you're not sharing with anybody else. It is their profit. 100% profit goes back to them. So how can you not be Islamic in that? So I thought it's Islamic. At the end of the whole thing, the conclusions were coming from all the bankers. Said, they said, you know what? Several speakers said, Grameen Bank is more Islamic bank than all the Islamic bank we have here. I wouldn't think they could have done any better. We are the one who are misusing many of the concepts in the name of Islamic banking. We're not doing it. One of the Islamic banking expert was telling me, Dr. Yunus, when you give this loan to buy the bamboo, for 25 cents. Why didn't you give her a bamboo instead of 25 cents? Because that's Islamic banking. Give the
in-kind.
In-kind.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Why didn't you give the bamboo instead of 25 cents? I immediately responded. He was looking at me. Oh, no, she was there. She was looking at me in her speech. I said, because I'm not a good bamboo buyer. I don't know which bamboo is a good bamboo, which is going to be a rotten bamboo. She's the expert because she lives all her life with the bamboo. Yeah. So why should I go and buy the bamboo for her? I give the money to her. She goes, finds out the right kind of bamboo for her. Why should I take this responsibility? And that became a point of discussion for the whole seminar. What are we doing, buying things for other or making fun of this or something? So anyway, so the consensus was that the Grameen Bank is the most Islamic bank than any other Islamic bank that we have.
What do you think of Islamic banking? What do you think of this, you know, which seems often a very highly contorted effort to try to make, you know, it's part of this project of reconciling Islam with modernity.
The point I made today, I'll repeat, I just said I don't want to go into the details of what you do. I said the only thing that pains me, you try to imitate the existing banking and kind of fit it in by saying this is the Islamic banking. Change the word here, change the word there and do that. I said I would have been happy with Islamic banking if you started from a scratch. This is our system banking. It is, may have some similarity, may not have some similarity, but that's not what it did. You just took the banking as it is, and you tried to kind of polish it up and give it a conversion and so on. I think that's where it went wrong, rather than building it up. Maybe by building it up, they would have structured it where it fits into the religious concepts and so on and so forth.
When you have been dealing around the world with the expansion of Grameen and Grameen-type microcredit, do you find that there are cultural differences that are important, or are poor women all over the world in this economic sense the same, that they're a good credit and they have been neglected?
The way I have tried to explain this, I said no matter where human being lives on this planet, they are the same human beings. They may wear different clothes, eat different food, speak different tongue, but the same human being. I said 98% of human beings is exactly the same. 2% is difference in the clothes and the languages and the food habits, the way we lived and so on. But for every word we use to describe our similarity, we use million words to describe our dissimilarity. So it sounds like there are million times more dissimilarities than similarities. I said, that's why the only thing we talk about is dissimilarities. We don't talk about similarities. I said, whether the woman lives in Bangladesh or the woman lives in Amazon forest is the same woman, same person, same problem. If she's a poor person, she goes through the same deprivation, rejection a Bangladeshi woman gets through. So that way you are responding to it in the same way, they will come back with the same response anyway. So I didn't see much of that difference. Even I was surprised when our Bangladeshi bank managers were sent to places like Costa Rica or Guatemala, they didn't speak a word of Spanish. We just sent them, hoping that they will somehow work it out. So they hired local people who can speak a little English, so through them they started it. 18 months later, I went to meet them, see what they have done. In one place, they have 10,000 borrowers and so on, and so on, having a big thing. And they are speaking very fluent their language. I said, how did you learn this? Well, if you have to work, you have to learn. Otherwise, you cannot communicate. Said, we first tried to learn Spanish. And then we came to this place in Guatemala, Atitlan Lake, around which all the Mayan people live. Then we found out nobody understands Spanish. So we had to start all over again, learning their language. In Mayan have about 22 languages. In one branch area, said there are 3 languages. So I have to learn all the three languages. Similar, but they don't understand each other. So I said, how did you get by? He said, well, one of our fallback position was money is the best language. It speaks to everybody. So we can stand behind it, and we indicated what we do, and our colleagues explained, and it worked very well. And today, they exactly do the same way. They came from the village where we worked, in Bangladeshi village. Out of them, they came to this place. For them, it's the same. Just a routine. They moved from one place to come to it. They did exactly the same way they would have done in the village. The question of modification, adaption, didn't even come to their mind because they're not used to modification, adaption. They just exactly that, and they got the same response. So this is how I would say that maybe... I'm saying in a kind of more exaggerated way, but basic thing is, it's the same system. Even as I was mentioning in Jackson Heights, it's the same thing. We have not changed anything. The same weekly repayment, five-member group, income-generating activity, everything that we do in Bangladesh. And also weekly savings. Each one of them has their savings account. And they put a weekly saving. How much? Even the smallest one, it's okay. You put it in. That's how we do.
So the question that really has always puzzled me, if this is such a good idea, why is it not spreading 10 times faster than
that's what I have been saying for the last many years.
Can you scale this? This is, sounds like a nice small idea.
Absolutely.
But you
cannot find fault with this. Because people need money, all you're doing is lending money. And they're paying back, you're covering your costs, it's self-sustaining, it's a business thing, that's nothing you can complain about. And people benefit from it right away, in many ways than one. The problem is, you need to go back to the legal framework. Our legislators are not prone to this kind of thing. Nobody has explained to them, because bankers are not paying attention to this. So only people in the NGOs and things, they are doing it. They couldn't explain. They didn't look like they are bankers. So the banking law should not come from them. What, the point I was making everywhere I go and taking advantage of this visibility, saying more loudly than I did before, saying that we need a new piece of legislation. Now the existing banking law is for creating a bank which is like a super tanker. It goes into deep water and carries a lot of cargo. It has to be a huge, big thing. And that's how the law has made them. Law has made it a big thing. Well, microcredit bank is like a dinghy boat. It goes into shallow water, delivered where nobody else will go. You cannot create a dinghy boat with the architecture of a super tanker. But that's the only architecture we have in the legal book. So nobody takes the initiative to create that little piece of legislation so that we can create this dinghy boat and go around and serve this thing. So this is the number one requirement, to create microcredit bank so that you don't have to bring millions of dollars of investment and so on. Right. Just a tiny little thing. If you have served 500 people in your neighborhood and you can be on your own, fantastic. If you want to expand, if your license is for only one branch, go ahead, it's a very small amount you paid and small capital you needed, and you want. If you want the second one, pay for the second one. Have the second one, too. So this is what it should be. And now that you have a microcredit bank, you need a regulatory body because now this has to be regulated. I said the present regulatory body, which regulates huge big banks, will not be the right agency to do this because this is a different kind of business. And I try to bring it to the attention by saying there's a game called football game, but there's a European football, there's an American football. The name of the game is the same, but the games are different. Microcredit bank and the conventional bank, both are banks, but these are different kind of banking. So you cannot be supervised by the same people because they don't understand. So I said, why don't we create a small supervisory authority which will be looking at the microcredit bank? Then everything is okay. Otherwise, it's just a business. You take the deposit, lend money to the people, and so on. Yeah. That legal framework is missing. It is left to the NGOs. The problem with NGOs, they cannot take deposit. So they're always running around to find money to give a loan. So if I have to give $100 loan, I have to find $100 somebody to give it to somebody. Yeah. So you need donor dependent. And donor dependent thing remains very small. Yeah. How much money can somebody give you? So that's how it remains.
So how have you been able to open it? Do you have to find countries where there is a permissible legal framework?
No, we start as NGO.
You start as an NGO.
Inside in Bangladesh, we have a separate legislation for us that we created right at the beginning. Because this issue I raised 31 years back. So today, like we started in Jackson Heights, we are going around finding a legal framework. Still it's an NGO trying to take the credit union license so that we can...
So even here you don't have
No, nothing. That I met the Fed chairman to explain. He understood it right away and his colleagues are very sympathetic. But it still couldn't find a legal framework which can be helpful for us. So again, we'll raise this issue with you and with all the other people that why can't we, even a trial basis legislation, give it experimental license to do that, to show that how good it is. Then you go and make it a regular licensing, regular legislation. Experimental legislation or experimental permission that yes, you are allowed to take deposit up to this extent for the next 10 years, 5 years. Show us what you do. And if it's good, and then we'll
The concern, I assume, is that they believe banks should be regulated because they are taking in public money and because there's potential of failure.
No, we are submitting to the regulatory body. That's what they're saying. The regulation is not the problem. They're always saying that why don't you create the bank under the existing banking law? Then the super tanker issue comes in. I cannot afford a huge big bank to lend few dollar loan, which is a very small loan. If you are having invested...
But what is the nature of the legislation that forces you to make it a big bank? Why is it that...
Because you have to, the equity requirement.
I see.
You have to have a huge equity before you are given a license to have a bank.
So all you need is small money to give small loans.
So how can you block out so much money to giving such a tiny loans?
What about the issue of the profit motive? I mean, you are doing this, and it's a wonderful thing you're doing it, but you know one of the great lines in Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations I always liked was he says, we depend for our dinner not on the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, and the baker. We appeal not to their sense of humanity, but to their sense of self-interest. There's one Muhammad Yunus. There will be many, many more people who would do this if they felt they could get rich while doing it. Is there enough of a profit motive to make this a model that's viable?
Grameen Bank can be done in both ways. I've been saying that the business can be two kinds. Because one type of business, the one that we are already familiar, is a business to make money. There is no other definition of a business. And profit maximization is the mission. I'm saying that interprets human being in a very narrow way because it kind of screen out all other dimensions of human being, allows only one dimension, single-dimensional human being. I said to accommodate multidimensionality of human being, we should have at least two kinds of business. One that we already know, for me. I am the beneficiary of entire business. The other one is all for others, nothing for me. And I'm calling it social business. It's a non-loss, non-dividend company with a social objective. It's a kind of cause-driven business. So microcredit can be run either way.
And presumably what you would do in the more for-profit way is the people who start the bank keep some of the dividend themselves rather than handing it all back to
the people.
So there is within them the model of framework.
That's all. So it can be for making money. I can lend money to the poor people and I make money by doing that. This is my business. This is a profit maximizing business. Or I can do it. I do it because I want to help people get out of poverty. I don't want any money for myself. I make money somewhere else. But here I don't want to make money. This is one. So let people decide which way they want to go. They can go both ways. I warn, in the case of the first one, if I want to lend money to make myself rich, I may become greedy to turn myself into a loan shark because I have an option now. If I want to make money, this is an opportunity. That's what the loan sharks do. And we don't like them. So while you're dealing with poor people, either you restrain yourself in somehow that, okay, I make money, but small money. But the other option is, here I don't make money.
Yeah.
I'll use some of my money, but not to make myself rich. But I take enormous pleasure seeing some people got out of the trouble that they got. Yeah. And this is my pleasure. And on that side, we created a lot of social businesses apart from microcredit. Like one business we created was a joint venture with Danone. It's a French company which makes yogurt and other milk products. We have a joint venture called Grameen Danone Company. And that company in Bangladesh produces yogurt, but for a special reason. There are millions of malnourished children in Bangladesh because of the problem of diet and their families and so on. So what we're doing, we're taking all the missing micronutrients, iodine, vitamin, zinc, iron, and putting into this yogurt and make it so cheap so that the poorest children can eat it and enjoy it. And the experts tell us that if a child can take 2 cups of yogurt every week over a period of, say, 18 months, they will regain all the micronutrients and they'll become healthy. If a child becomes healthy, can protect himself or herself from other diseases in future. So this company is working. Danone has agreed they will never take any dividend out of it. This is a social objective-driven company. For them, it's a pleasure that their yogurt is helpful, bringing nutrition to the children of Bangladesh. So it is a social business. The investor can take back the investment money, but nothing of the dividend. Company makes profit. Profit stays with the company to expand, to improve, and so on. And recently, we have another joint venture, again encouraged by Grameen Danone. This is a water company. Bangladesh has a serious water problem. With UNICEF's tremendous amount of encouragement, Bangladesh has put lots of tube wells around the country for good quality water, and we enjoyed this quality water very well. But now what happened, this is bringing arsenic in the water. So it's all arsenic contaminated water of high level contamination and creating lots of diseases and so on, including skin cancer. But people have no option. Keep drinking this arsenic all the time. And then if you look at the surface water, Bangladesh has lots of surface water, but very polluted water. So diseases everywhere. So we are caught. Our villages, people in the village are caught between the arsenic and the disease. So we are creating this water company. It's a joint venture with Veolia, which is again the largest water company in the world. We are doing it as a very small water treatment plant in the cluster of villages and producing treated good quality drinking water and making sure even the poorest family can afford to pay for it. Make it so cheap that everybody can. And the company recovers its cost. So once this plant goes into operation and everybody is happy, we can just repeat because this way everybody can have good drinking water. And it is within their control. It's a social business. Nobody's making money out of your difficult situation. So that will be another case of social business. So we can create a lot of those social businesses where nobody else is coming. Profit makers are not coming because it's not worth going there. Government is incapable of doing it because they don't have the capacity to provide those kind. They don't have the money. They don't have the administrative capacity to handle it. So social business would be a good solution. Healthcare can be a very good social business. So there's enormous varieties of things where social business can take a position and address these issues.
But it is a very optimistic view of capitalism and of human nature in a sense.
Right.
I mean, you really do think that there is there's a large segment of the population of business leaders who would be willing to put in the time, the energy, the resources for something that is not, at the end of the day, maximizing profits for shareholders.
People don't feel threatened when I say that, even the business people. I give the example. I said, you have a corporate social responsibility budget, don't you? I said, yes. Why didn't you use it? This is what you already earmarked, to do good to people. You're not expecting any money out of it. Entire Grameen Danone plant that we have, the total investment is just about $1 million. But it makes such a powerful message. And many companies have so much big corporate social responsibility budget. So even if without disturbing what you got, still you can do that out of that. And many companies have foundations. big foundations with lots of money. So I said, in the foundation you are giving away money, it's a charity money, you do something. Charity money is good, I'm not opposed to that. But if you can convert that idea, what your objective of that charity is, into a social business format. After all, you're business people, so you can, if you use your mind, you'll come out with a brilliant social business idea. And then use this foundation money to help do that. That way, if it is charity, charity dollar has only one life. You can use it only once. But the moment you convert it into social business, it has endless life.
Yeah.
You created an institution. Every year, with the foundation money, if you create one little institution, it will inspire the whole world. If this can be done, we can do it. And gradually, thought process will start changing. People, young people will say, when I grow up, should I work for a profit-making company? Or should I work for a social business company? This is a choice. After all, free market is about choice. You are giving people choice. Also, there will be competition between the social business and the other businesses. That's widening the market concept. So I'm not destroying what already has. I'm only improving what it has. And I'm not forcing anybody to do anything. I said, this is the option available. If you want to do it, if you want to make your foundation money to go into this, this will be wonderful. If you want to do corporate social responsibility money going into it, that will be wonderful. So this is the way to begin. And some people say, why corporate social? I can invest. I have lots of money already. I can create a big social business so that I can address these issues. Like I mentioned in my book, that 47 million people in America don't have health insurance. And this would be a good subject for social business. So we can create a social business so that we can address it. Millions of people are on welfare.
Yeah.
We can create social business so that nobody has to be on welfare. This is the way I design my business, in such a way nobody has to be on welfare, yeah. And I create jobs for them. This is my business, and this is something we can do. So there are many things that we can look at, and millions of people cannot open bank account in this country. And they have to, when they get their check, they go to the check cashing companies, and they rip them off because they don't have the access to the banking mechanism. Somebody said, okay, I'll create a social business where anybody can open a bank account and I'll cash everything for them.
I'd like to take questions from the floor. If anyone has them, there are two mics, one on each side. Please feel free to ask really about anything you want, but do make sure it's a question and not a statement. Ma'am, why don't you start
us
off?
I have a question for Dr. Yunus.
Yes.
I was fascinated when you went into the South Bronx. I mean, this is, in theory, the richest country in the world. Why do we need you? Why did you do it? It seems to me to be at least as much an implied criticism as it is a helpful gesture.
No, one way all societies have problems. The question is, sometimes we feel that this is beyond me, government should take care of it, I'm not supposed to do it. The issue that I'm raising, I am capable of doing it. Every single human being is capable of doing it if we put our thinking behind it. If there is a problem, I can design something so that I can address the problem. Maybe in this design I cannot solve every problem, but one problem I can solve. I cannot solve for everybody, but I can solve for some people, at least one people, one person. Why don't we do that? So I'm suggesting the social business idea as a kind of platform on which we can address those issues. So here there are problems, and you go to any society, they'll have problems. But that's what we are for, solving problems. That's the challenge of human being. If everything is resolved, would it be fun to live in this world? No. It's so perfect. What do you do with yourself? So we are happy that there's some, but instead of just watching them, we should be putting our creativity, our innovative ideas in solving those problems. After we solve these problems, there will be some more problems. This is what the human life is all about. Then we'll address another thing to solve those problems. Today we have the problem of water is a big problem, climatic change is a big problem, and now food crisis is a big problem. It's all over the world. Right now we are going through a big food crisis. And God knows how long it will take. It's not one season food crisis. You read in the newspaper demonstrations against the government and everything. Because food prices suddenly went berserk. And it's the poor people who are absolutely crushed. And the children in those families are absolutely crushed. And still we are not paying attention to it. And somebody has to get together what is happening to the world. Because it is maybe the beginning of a bigger problem. So these are the things that we should... what I'm saying, organize ourselves to respond to those problems and get it resolved before it gets too big and too wild.
Sarah? Dr. Yunus, I wanted to ask in what way the Grameen banking model and the credit union or cooperative banking model, in what way they converge and in what way they are different in the principles in, that they follow?
They came from almost the same background, that since we are not being served by somebody else in the conventional bank, so why don't we create something that we can solve our own problem? So that was the initiative. But most of the time, credit union has pushed into giving loans for consumption purposes. So that's where we depart. That microcredit is for income generating purposes. And also credit union is their own money used for their own purposes, basically. And Grameen Bank, it doesn't have to be my own money. I just borrow for income generating and I pay you back. Where you got your money for microcredit, that is the debate we're having, whether donors give the NGO or I take deposit and lend money. Where would the people tell me, oh, if you have a small, tiny little bank, nobody will deposit in your bank. People will be worried you'll run away with the money. I said, yes, that's true. That's why the regulatory body comes in. And maybe some deposit insurance program has to be introduced so that the credibility has been established. At the same time, for deposit, it shouldn't be a big task. If I can persuade one company in my neighborhood, a grocery company or a pharmaceutical company or whatever company, would you please bring a small part of your deposit into a big bank to my account? I give you the same facility, same interest rate, but this money will be loaned to the people in our neighborhood so that they can change their life. I'm sure anybody with just one single account, that's all it needed. It's money is right there. So this is the benefit of that, coming into the format of a regular banking than credit union. But credit union can be converted to also do this.
Ma'am, you have the last question.
Millennium Development Goals are one of the ways the UN is trying to address poverty in the world. And Bangladesh currently is doing extremely well in meeting those goals. And my question to you tonight is, to what extent do you think the Grameen Bank has played a role in that?
I would say important role, microcredit. Grameen Bank also inspired many other programs within Bangladesh as a microcredit program. So in total, today, 80% of the poor families of Bangladesh have access to microcredit. So they are very organized, very financially sound system they belong to. So financing became easy for them. And it's expanding. In the next 4 years, probably we'll come very near to 100% coverage. This will be one single country in the whole world to achieve that. Already, whatever intensity we have in Bangladesh, no country can go anywhere near that. So that is one exceptional situation. It is not as much the money who changed Bangladesh in microcredit. It is the empowerment of women who changed Bangladesh tremendously. And Millennium Development Goal, not only on the issue of reduction of poverty, almost all 8 Millennium Development Goals, Bangladesh is set to achieve them. And most of it because of the total dramatic change in the status of women it has created. This little money has changed everything. And in a very friendly way, it's not a hostile way or anything, in a very friendly way, it happened, society has gone through the transformation. And I just mentioned about the food prices. If these food prices are not solved, it's allowed to go its own way, Millennium Development Goals anywhere will be very difficult to finally achieve. We have accomplished a lot in Bangladesh, come a long way, halfway. What we have accomplished in the next half, we may have to give it up because of the crushing problem that is creating in this. It's all about poverty, and it is hitting the poor people the most.
Let me ask you a final question then, Mohammed, taking off on that. In your book, in your life, you have worked in the places where government has been unable to or unwilling to or impossible. But you look at Millennium Development Goals, you look at the issue of poverty, you look at your licenses. At the end of the day, you need the government to start doing smart things.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Well, I mean, I'm not getting government off the hook. Simply saying that there are things government can do, there are things government cannot do. We kind of put everything on their shoulder, and then they cannot perform, and we scream about them. So those are the things which you're not good at. Why don't we take it off? Or let them do it right, to the extent that they can do it, and rest we handle it, so that we share, and it becomes a competition between us and them. No problem. They are not a different animal. We're from the same society. But these approval process, regulatory process, this is exclusive authority of the government. A bank cannot regulate themselves. No matter how much we talk about self-regulation, ultimately some big guys say, who cares?
Right.
And nobody can do anything about it. So that's where we need the government for that. Policy changes, very important thing. And to monitor what we are doing, let people know what is the total situation of the country in terms of Millennium Development Goals and so on. After all, Millennium Development Goals, not only action is important, inspiration is also important. You inspire people to achieve it. By adopting this goal at the United Nations didn't pour in money to do that. But they created a dream for the whole world. Wonderful dream. Never happened in the whole history of mankind. Saying boldly, we want to reduce poverty by half by 2015. A number and a date. You cannot be bolder than that. And people say it's a crazy thing. This is politics. People will soon forget. Even people used to kid at the beginnings by saying, well, UN is good in goal setting. They never care whether they get it there or not. Like in the 90s, they said education for all by the year 2000, health for all by the year 2000, everything for all by the year 2000. we repeated it like parrots all over the world. But when 2000 came, we are talking about something else, as if nothing, we don't have to even talk about it. But today, Millennium Development Goals is a serious thing. And many countries are achieving it. Not just one or two. Many countries are achieving it. And that's a fantastic thing. Only Africa is the one which is still lagging behind, and it's still half the way to go. Still we can do something. But with this food crisis and the chain reaction of that food crisis coming from the oil price because of the expenses in agriculture, climatic change, because many droughts, many floods, many of those are related to this chain of events. And also the question of the devaluation of dollar, hiking up the price of oil and so on. So all these things interlinked with each other. Unless we address this, we will be in serious trouble.
On that, for an optimist, you end on a pessimistic
note. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Oh my God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.